planes have crashed into the World Trade Center.
If you're in this fight, boys, you mark my words. There's no playbook here. We're going to have to write it ourselves. We can't tell our enemies from our allies. Every step we take is on a minefield from 100 wars. Anyone who tells you they've done this before is lying, sir.
50,000 Al-Qaeda fighters. And you're just an army of 12.
Once we land, we're teaming up with a warlord that we know nothing about.
We take horses.
We take horses. We take horses. We take horses.
My name's Sandy Kenyon. Welcome to the movies of the back of the cab. We just saw 12 Strong. Well, now we're 5 Strong. We're also giving it 5 Strong stars. Wow. Who thought that American Army Special Forces Green Berets and horses would go to Greva to create a great story of a movie that I enjoyed very much? I'm Sandy Kenyon.
I give it 5 bags of popcorn and a little horse.
I love Sandy Kenyon as much as he loves literally any movie.
Go see it. Yeah. My review is, did I like this movie? Nay. Friends, we're here. It's Chapo. As you may have gathered, it's another movie episode. What are we exposing ourselves to this time on your behalf? Why, it's the movie 12 Strong, aka the horse soldiers of Afghanistan.
Hell yeah.
Horse troops.
The mounted horsemen of the American Green Beret and Special Forces.
You guys are out there thinking, oh, I respect and I support the troops. I'm a good person. Well, fuck you. Were you supporting the horse troops? If you weren't, you're a piece of shit.
You weren't, because we kept them a secret.
Exactly.
Because America doesn't appreciate its horse heroes.
Yep, and you're a piece of shit for not respecting the horse troops.
You know, I was talking to my friend Cal, shout out to Cal, about this, who's like, isn't it cool that we're so stupid we don't know the word cavalry anymore?
We know it. It's just not as cool as horse soldiers. It sounds like badass centaurs.
These were tactical dragoons.
Amber, we're so stupid we don't even know the term Calvary anymore. I'm talking about where Christ was crucified, folks.
I like the idea that like there was just no tactical advantages to horses, but there was like a horse girl guy way high up in the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And he had like a camo Lisa Frank binder that he was drawing horses in. He's,
you know,
like,
finally,
this is called
movie.
A Shetland pony. You cannot use it for dressage, but I do like their coats.
It's like, you will be attaching makeshift horns to your horses to create beautiful unicorns.
But I was actually very upset because it took a really long time to get to the horses.
We will register individually our many complaints of this movie is the lack of horses being chief among them.
Will they get to the horses? Dearth of horses.
We are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 strong today to bring you
the horse
the
podcasters.
Horse soldier.
We're podcasting from the backs of horses.
Ow, my balls. You know, real Chapo heads know, of course, that the show started with the review of the Michael Bay movie, 16 Hours, The Secret Soldiers
16 hours.
Of Benghazi.
16 hours.
That's what I said.
Wrong.
What?
13 hours.
13 hours? Okay. There's numbers involved.
Matt, I think your home monitor sash is caught in the couch right now.
I just know that the fans would howl and hoot if they heard
you're
you.
You're the fans. I'm glad you did first. I'm glad you did first.
I've got to be their voice. I am your voice.
Your whiny, pedantic voice.
People who screech and howl and bang their heads when they hear a mispronunciation or a misstated fact on the show. I am your voice.
Yeah, the purposely forgotten man.
Wait, I thought the show started in Langley, Virginia, when some American intelligence officers had the idea of a way to destabilize the American left.
Well, our dry run was appearing on Street Fight to review 13 Hours.
Now, that was later. That was after Project Arcturus began.
We've later gone on to review American Sniper and discuss films in recent cinema history that depict American history. That depict our Star Wars, our Infinity Wars, our wars on the media.
Our wars on the ghosts.
the eternal war on ghosts.
Afghanistan, of course, being an Infinity War.
You know, if you said the ghost
hunt. Ooh.
Wow.
Commentary.
Searing.
Okay. You want to fucking play, dude? Okay, check this out. Our lives were so simple. We used to look up the IMDb for Omar Sharif. Now we worry about Mazar-e Sharif.
That is funny because I actually did look up Omar Sharif's IMDb just last week. So Felix is on my wavelength.
In your window.
Keeping yeah. in my window. So yeah, this sort of thing we talked about. There is now, this movie 12 Strong came out in January of this
year.
That
is officially the month now where there is a War on Terror meathead propaganda extravaganza. We've had this. We've had 13 Hours.
Lone Survivor.
Lone Survivor. We have had American Sniper.
Next year we have Gran Torino 2 where the racist car is back and it's going to Afghanistan.
Yes.
No one's ever tried just calling these people the N-word.
So, yeah, January is now, it seems Hollywood turns out one movie a year that dramatizes the very recent past in our various wars on terror as, you know, service to the military-industrial complex and the imperial propaganda machine that is our media.
Yes,
and
it's Hollywood
media
rendering
entertainment complex.
Caesar, as it were.
So we decided to check out this one. We've been meaning to watch this movie ever since I think we saw a trailer for it in theaters when we were for another movie we're reviewing, probably the Justice Wars, the Wonder the Woman Wars.
They're called Pride Wars.
So, and now finally we checked it out. So this movie is 12 Strong. It takes place in the very weeks following 9/11, and it depicts the 12 American Special Forces ops who went across
Green
the border.
Green motherfucking berets.
Into Afghanistan to work with the Northern Alliance and basically point lasers at columns full of Taliban and blow the shit out of them with B-52 bombers.
You know, but they used horses!
Amber brought up the war on ghosts, and if you literally sent the fucking assholes from Ghost Hunters who use PSPs and Game Boy Advances to think they can detect the supernatural, you sent them over there and said, if you point this at anything, you can blow it up, we would have the same result in Afghanistan. You'd have the same movie.
So let's start by going around. First reactions, critiques, impressions of 12 Strong. I will begin by saying its greatest crimes are, of course, being a piece of imperial propaganda that glorifies the war on terror in Afghanistan. But its chief crime, in my opinion, is criminally underutilizing the talents of Michael Shannon in what would otherwise be a leading role in this movie. He is off screen for what seems like hours at a time, and when he does is on screen, has very little to do or say that is noteworthy at all. So 12 Strong, guilty of Michael Shannon crimes. Matt.
I loved it. It made me want to get a horse soldier of my own.
You wanted to become a horse soldier girl?
I want to get a horse soldier for my own home to protect me from Taliban attackers.
Yeah, you see, regular people use soldiers as companion dogs, but they get scared easily because of certain things they did, so they need companion dogs, and the companion dogs get PTSD for being the companion dogs to the soldier, and they need, like, companion hamsters, and it just, shit trickles down, man.
And that's why there are so many rescue pit bulls.
Yeah, because pit bulls are the lowest totem of the dog universe.
No, it's a very bad movie, and my main criticism, I mean, once again, stipulating that it is awful propaganda, from just an entertainment perspective, my problem was that it had absolutely no visual flair or point of view at all. It was incredibly flat. It could have been a TNT series or something.
Yeah.
It was very, very visually uninspiring. It had none of the sweaty intensity of a Michael Bay or even a Peter Berg. I was longing for some Dutch angles, some swooping close-ups of sweat-drizzled faces. None of that. Just very basic shots and choices.
It really reminded me, it's like a bunch of guys go into like an impossible mission on a helicopter, and whenever I see that in a movie, I can't help but think of Predator.
Yeah.
And how just the brilliant filmmaking and screenwriting in that movie, within 2 minutes of that movie, you establish every single character and they stand out in your mind instantly.
Yep.
This movie took 2 hours and I didn't know who the fuck any of these guys were.
Nope, not at all.
Not a single
they
witty one-liner.
At all.
You know, no one told us there was no good, you know.
Where's our stock characters?
Yeah,
where's
exactly.
our snappy nerd?
Yeah,
where's our sarcastic tough guy?
Where's
the
our
silent
racial
one that
stereotypes?
Grows on us?
You know?
Hey, they call me Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You know, that guy was nowhere to be seen.
Oh, yeah. There was one guy who, as Felix pointed out, looked like Terry Richardson. And that was basically it. They were totally interchangeable. One guy looked like an ass McShit success win beard
I thought Dave Navarro.
But none of them stood out at all.
The Northern Alliance is all about living Moss, and we're here to help them.
Yeah, the soldiers all looked like vibes guys. They all looked like they were going to go, "How are you living, brother? It's so good to see you." A lot of shoulder rubbing.
The lead actor in the film was Chris Hemsworth, Horse Thor in this movie. Michael Shannon backing him up in a completely thankless, forgettable role. And Michael Pena is the only other star in the movie. That's about it.
The rest of them are absolutely interchangeable.
Completely interchangeable. Oh, the great character actor William Fichtner shows up looking like he's at stage four rear base, you know, guy on the other end of the
phone.
He's
giving them orders, and you expect him to have a chemotherapy rig strapped to him, injecting him with drugs. He looked like he was on his last fucking legs. He looked like Roy Cohn in Angels in America.
Fichtner is a very like striking looking guy, and you always notice him when he's in a movie.
Sharp features,
very sharp face, and in this one, it took me a second to realize it because it was like he was so gaunt and bald and completely. It's like he had alopecia or something.
It was pretty
completely
bad.
Hairless. Maybe he was playing a real bald general.
He looked like a grub worm in a uniform.
Virgil, your thoughts.
Well, the one thing I object to the most would probably have to be how it dehumanizes Muslims in every frame. That was the big one. But otherwise, I was pretty upset by the lack of wisecracks, you know, interesting, flavorful dialogue.
Yeah. I mean, a terrible movie like Michael Bay's Transformers does more in the opening seconds of introducing a bunch of troops, most of whom will be killed with Josh Duhamel's troops. In that movie than in this one, because they're on a train, and I even remember this, they're on an airplane, and one of them is going, "I can't wait to get my grandma's étouffée. Oh, it's so good. Oh, Chateaubriand." And then a redheaded guy with glasses goes, I wish I was at Fenway Park drinking a beer and having a hot dog."
And then a guy with a perfectly symmetrical haircut is like, "I can't wait to get back on Kinja."
Yeah. And you just are like,
you guys,
I already have more about
Stripes.
These characters than anything that happened in this movie.
Well, instead, what passed for comic relief was the manly banter among the horsemen, which was like sub-Imgur comment level type of humor. At one point, one of the interchangeable guys says to the other one, "Who do you think would win in a fight, Margaret Thatcher or Queen Elizabeth?" And the other guy shakes his head and goes, "Where the fuck do you come up with random stuff like that?
Yeah, it's like if you brought this stuff to, like, you know, 9gag or something, they'd be like, "This fucking sucks. This is so unfunny." It's like the writers of this movie, if they see Epic Mealtime, their brain will overdose on serotonin. They cannot even conceive of something that funny.
Sorry, your first thoughts and reactions to the film.
Oh, you know what? I just realized what this genre of movie is. This is a Christian Amanpour-ass movie. You know what I mean?
It's I do.
Yeah, right. It's like Christiane Amanpour, if you've watched CNN, she's like very serious. It's like it's a very serious interview with, you know, Christine Lagarde or something. And you're supposed to think it's good journalism just by virtue of it being incredibly boring. And that's what this genre of movie is. It's so dull. It has such little character and so little actual suspense because you don't give a fuck about any of the characters. You're like, "Oh, this is good," because it's not very interesting to me. There's nothing exciting in it. It has this air of like self-seriousness and a very sharp global sense of moral grays where it's like, "Oh, well, you know, prima facie, we should be in Afghanistan. That's good. But sometimes we upset the people of Afghanistan. Just something to think about." You ever thought about that? That sometimes war is hard? No, we should 100% be there. But war, you know, sometimes people die. And there's just no actual underlying moral current. It's just, you know, hey, just asking questions.
Overall, it's a movie that reminds us that we live in a society.
Yeah, well, We Live in a Society movie is like Limitless or something. Okay. Those actually like go for something. This is just, it's just plopping a bunch of olive drabs at your feet and going, "Well, what do you think?"
Amber?
Not enough horses.
Not enough horses at all.
Not enough horses. The horses were not developed. You saw no one have a relationship with the horse except Daddy once. One time. The guy they were working with, who's now the vice president of Afghanistan, he like kisses his horse on the forehead once. But other than that, not nearly enough horse character development, not enough horse close-ups, not enough horse action shots. They really buried the horses in this one.
Which is weird because their mission, as I understood it from watching the film, was that they had to fuck every horse in Afghanistan. That's what I gathered.
Not only that, I wasn't really paying attention. When we were getting ready to watch this movie and I was walking over here thinking about it, I would have been willing to bet there would have been at least one scene where, like, they call in an airstrike and then one of their horses dies and then, like, Chris Hemsworth is like,
attachment to the horse? Look, it's a sentimental movie already. Why not add some kind of dimension to the horse with part of it? Otherwise, it's just a dumb movie where you're underutilizing the horses and Michael Shannon. That's criminal.
They ride the horse. They get set in Afghanistan by a low-flying helicopter, and then they meet up with the Northern Alliance guys. Then they get the horses. They take the horses through some mountain pass to a camp, and then that's kind of it until the very end of the movie with the horses. There's not a lot of horse action. There's not shots of these guys who don't know how to ride horses, learning how to ride horses. There's no of them bonding with the horses. They just take them from A to B.
I feel like this was a bait and switch for women.
Take your girlfriend to the movie.
Horses, bitches love horses. And it's true. We do be loving horses.
You almost wish for Bush era culture, because if this movie came out in like 2005, the world's most beautiful, charming, nice horse just turned into fucking biryani by a technical, and then just like 45 minutes straight of B-52 smashing Taliban, and it's like, we'll never get that horse back, but we found the horse's babies. There are going to be more horses for the children of Afghanistan. Like that, you know, they did that. It's like,
if this was
cool,
made
man.
During Bush era, they would have given a horse an Oscar.
Yes.
The nation would have fallen in love with the lead horse.
They'd be like, Michael Moore, don't you fucking look at that horse, you piece of shit.
Michael Moore.
You wanted him to die.
Michael Moore is on stage just being like, we're in the position of a documentary of telling truth. And this war is a lie, Mr. Bush. And then it just like clomps on stage. And there's a guy with a sword
and
on it.
Just cuts
him down. And they're like, clomp the stage twice if you support the people of Afghanistan, Silver.
That's literally what it was like in America until like 2005. It was the most psychotic time ever, and it ruled.
My friend was telling me about that, actually. He was talking about like sort of like online pylon culture. He's like, oh yeah, it's bad. He's like, but you should have tried being anti-war movement.
Ooh, yeah.
Right after. He's like, you don't even know what kind of a pariah you were. People went insane.
They fired Phil Donahue.
Yeah.
Poor Phil.
Online, you would get like, if you posted like on a message board, not even like, I'm totally against the war, blah, 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 I'm against Empire. If you were like, we shouldn't invade Iraq. Guys named like Lord Pancake Beard or whatever would be like, you fucking piece of shit, and an admin would ban you. It was awful.
Yeah, and you had those kind of raging, bellowing idiots, but even the logical, reasonable guys were all about, you can't see the evidence of Iraq's pattern of avoiding sanctions. They're clearly establishing a weapons program. Did you listen to Colin Powell, you idiot?
That's how crazy Fallujah was. It totally turned the tide of my forum that I posted on and in my IRC. It just went so poorly that we were like, you know what? Fuck these guys.
Well, Iraq was later. This is a movie that takes place literally in the weeks after 9/11.
The good invasion, as Obama said. Yeah. I'm not against war. I'm against stupid war. War in Afghanistan? That was very smart.
So the movie opens with that Tuesday morning we all never forget. I'm talking about 9/11. The movie opens with 9/11. Chris Hemsworth's kids are watching Alvin and the Chipmunks, and they're like, we interrupt this children's cartoon for a very important bulletin. Oh, wait, the movie actually begins with a montage that goes back to
the
original 93 World Trade Center bombing, which, like I said,
that's a little more underground.
A lot of kids don't know about
obscure.
That this day. The guy with the hook, Notorious B.I.G. was not a psychic, kids. He was referencing something that happened in 1993. Then there is the Khobar Towers bombing in, where is that, in Kenya?
No, there was the embassy
bombings.
Yeah, in Tanzania.
And, okay. And then yeah. when
and then the coal.
Al-Qaeda hit the USS J. Cole. The most miracle ship in the Navy. They hit it.
So well, they're establishing that America was at war with a secret force that they couldn't understand.
So, and then they showed, well, before 9/11, they showed a clip of Vladimir Putin saying,
"Yeah, that was
odd. Something bad's going to happen. They're going to strike."
Well, I was wondering if like the sort of resistance paranoiac people had gotten into the actually the only reason why we were in Afghanistan was because of Russia. Because like I'm sure they would try and like twist that, right?
Yeah. If they have. Well, that's the thing is you can take that either way. So if you're a MAGA chud who loves Putin now, you watch this movie and you go, "Yep, see, he was trying to warn us. He knew. Damn it, Bill Clinton didn't pay attention."
Yeah, that's what.
But
I
if
thought.
You're a resistance person, you see that and you're like, "Aha!
The Russian bear leaves his trap.
Yeah,
he's showing
yeah.
his hand. And I see you, sir."
And the other thing they show, and everyone forgets this, was 2 days before 9/11, the head of the National Northern Alliance was assassinated by the Taliban. Yes.
That's important for this movie because much of the plot of the movie deals with this Northern Alliance and all of their internal politics and shenanigans. Before we get into the plot of this film and the mission itself, I'd like to do another round robin. Where were you guys when 9/11 happened? Fans of the show will remember I was using drugs for self-care. But
where were you when the world stopped turning?
How about the rest of you guys? Amber, do you remember where you were?
I was in, I was trying to tell Felix this earlier, but it is kind of true. I was in math class and I, surprise, skipped grades in math. And so I was around these much like older students and then my other friend who skipped grades. And he turned on the normally closed circuit TV because they were doing like a live feed of it or whatever, and we were watching it and we're like, "Oh shit, what happened?" And we're like, "Oh wow, someone's really bad at flying." Like, I'm not kidding, we were just like, clearly this is a mistake.
Is Mr. Magoo flying that plane?
Yeah. And then we saw the second one hit and we were like, "Oh shit." And then we saw a fall and everything and we didn't have any conception. I think we thought it was like a, you know, McVeigh type situation or something, because we didn't quite know about Islamophobia yet.
Well, we all would learn.
Yeah.
We all would learn.
We had a crash course in the next 12 hours.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, it was super fucked up. And I remember my mom turning into Stan's mom in that South Park episode where she just becomes pre-verbal and melts to the couch and can't stop watching 24-hour news.
It was a good time for news. Do you guys have any memorable 9/11 stories?
I was in high school. I just remember they brought out the TVs and we just got to watch TV all day, which was pretty dope.
Yeah.
I remember popping a celebratory bottle of champagne in our underground bunker, me and the rest of the Delta Sector boys, on a successful application of the thermite plasma spray to the exterior girders of the World Trade Center. And also all of the detonation cords that we'd wrapped around the pillars of Building 7.
Felix, weren't you supposed to be at the World Trade Center that day, but you got a call?
No, Felix was like, I'll never forget oversleeping that day and letting all my boys down.
We're actually retconning my age for the Twitch stream, so for all intents and purposes, I wasn't born yet. Just a regular 17-year-old kid on Twitch with my friends.
So, like I said, the
one thing I do remember...
Felix
it didn't happen
Black
to me,
Tienerman.
But I like to believe it did because it's so funny is that a friend of mine heard, and this is all hearsay, but I believe it in my heart, is that in the town where I was, there's a restaurant chain. It's a Midwestern restaurant chain for delicious Mexican food called Taco John's.
Oh, Taco John's.
Famed for their potato oles. And as anyone will remember, 9/11 was on a Tuesday. And my friend heard a man at the Taco John's who, in the middle of everyone absorbing the information that they were hearing about this attack, said incredulously, "Is it still Taco Tuesday?" I like to think that Taco John's was like some of the gas stations in the area was just jacking up prices. Said, "No, tacos are $500.
I'd like to think that someone just sort of like stoically nodded, maybe like wiped a tear away from their eye and be like, it'll always be Taco Tuesday.
That was,
or the terrorists win.
That was people's favorite thing on 9/11. People who were like, you know, look, we live in another big city in America, Council Bluffs, Iowa. We may be hit next. Just like the bravest thing we can do is keep living our lives.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just keep doing exactly what we're doing now. If I stopped having this affair and cheating on my wife, it's almost like the terrorists would win.
Man, it was so easy to have an affair in 2001.
I got to figure that a lot of people decided to say fuck it and have affairs. If not on 9/11, then shortly after that, when the first anthrax letters were found.
It was called terror sex. And I swear to God, someone wrote an article about this, I think for the New Yorker, about being in Midtown or something and basically doing a booty call and then just fucking.
Oh, God. Imagine just shoving someone's like orange pastel iMac off a desk and just knocking their boots. God, I wish.
And just coming together.
I wish I was, you know, born around that time.
So our heroes of the movie are, of course, the
troops.
The troops.
Also in real life.
The best of the best, the Green Berets. 9/11 happens. They know what's going down. They want in on the fight. Our main character, Chris Hemsworth, he's just like, I don't know, retired or something, or
he's
put in
transferring
his...
to a staff job.
Oh, okay. And then he's like, he rips up his transfer papers because he's like, fuck
it. That was the older one, right? He was supposed to retire then.
No, Shannon was supposed to retire.
One of them was supposed to get a different job, and I think Michael Shannon was supposed to retire. They're both saying, nope.
Chris Hemsworth is the sort of young green officer who's nonetheless respected by his men. Shannon is the more grizzled sergeant with combat experience. But, you know, Hemsworth, you know, he doesn't have any combat experience, which later comes into play in the movie.
Right, and they need to pick a captain for the horse mission.
Yeah.
And they pick between... five men with 100 years of experience among them, which is really interesting to me because I'm trying to think of, like, if you're an older officer in 2001, what kind of experience did you have? Grenada, the Iraq War, which took like what,
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
Standing around a occupied hamburger
Bosnia
in Bosnia.
Yeah.
Tail hook.
Panama, just standing outside the Vatican consulate playing fucking Van Halen, waiting for Noriega
Iran
to come
Contra.
Out.
We need someone with 20 years of experience lying to Congress.
What you don't remember is like anyone who is too young to have joined the military during Vietnam, but like old enough to be sort of like a low or mid-level officer at that time or NCO. They were former Arkansas State troopers who saw combat experience murdering people for Bill Clinton in the early 90s.
And flying cocaine into the MENA airport.
That's right.
So
Chris Hemsworth got that gig by killing Vince Foster.
Yeah.
No, Chris Hemsworth actually gets the gig by kicking over like a cabinet in his office.
Yeah, when they tell him something, he gets super pissed and they're like, well, that's all we need. You're our new pissed sergeant. Here's some new unreleased Eminem tracks that haven't even hit LimeWire yet. Let's go.
We're giving you the official pat, the official government pass to use LimeWire legally. So going into Afghanistan.
The men were just talking. We know you haven't seen combat, but the way that you kicked that wall, you were so pissed. You're ready.
So we know what's going down. There's a little bit of perfunctory, just the barest perfunctory introduction of the three main characters' spouses.
Yeah.
And the, like the sort of the going away to war scene.
You come back to me, yo. You hear?
And I believe Michael Pena's wife is just like, you're not getting any nookie before you go away because, you know, you got to be fighting strong to kill those Taliban.
Yeah, you
got
to be real horned up to
go
to war.
Real horny to bring to death.
Reedless Estrada.
And then...
This is before, like, the Volcel technology had really developed, but it was kind of an introductory period.
By Volcel technology, you mean jacking off?
This was
before the soldiers discovered jacking off.
And in the first of many, many bitterly ironic moments in the movie that it's ludicrous to think the writers and producers of the movie weren't aware of when they wrote it, but seemingly included in the movie anyway, is when Peña says, if that's the case, this war is going to be over before you know it. It's going to be over in 2 weeks. Which is funny because that war is still going on right now.
Well, we did
throughout the movie.
Too. Yeah.
We ended the war where we fought, like, Taliban 1. They're our friends now.
Taliban 2.
Yeah, Taliban 2. The Taliban 2 war is, like, pretty new.
Again, we dispense of the pleasantries here in America.
Okay, here's my idea for a better movie, and it should have diverged right at that point. You see the 9/11 happen, and you know all the soldiers are riled up, and then it's the night before they're deployed, and they're, you know, in bed with their wives and a pillow talk and all that shit, and then they go off, and their wives see them off, and then right away they go, "We're all gonna get laid," and the whole rest of the movie is one of those rowdies ladies night type movies about military wives just sucking and fucking. It's like a Rebel Wilson movie. She would be one of them. And Anna Kendrick would be like the one who's kind of on the fence about it, but she gets charmed by an Antifa guy.
Folks, we call the boys on the home front horse soldiers for a different reason.
8.5 strong.
Unfortunately, they didn't make that movie. Hollywood isn't ready to do a movie about the real heroes, the wives who cheat on their husbands when they go to war.
And their boyfriends.
Yeah, and their boyfriends, yeah. So instead, we get a movie about a team of guys who's, you know, flown over the Hindu Kush Mountains in a rickety-ass helicopter that seemed very dangerous and unsafe. They all got hypoxic because there was no oxygen masks, and they were flying a helicopter at 25,000 feet.
Dude,
that was
kind of
cool.
Which you're just not supposed to do. And they're like, it's fine.
I thought that
soldiers,
was like the
soldiers are like dogs. You give them just a little Dramamine for a car trip.
It's like they're like the Mitt Romney dogs in this case. They're freezing their asses off up there. I thought that was basically the only cool scene in the movie.
That was a cool scene.
I was like, oh, this is kind of neat.
And they say, you know, oh, well, helicopters, a Chinook has never flown at 25,000 altitude before. Which is funny because if the military just does that constantly, no wonder their helicopters keep crashing.
Military?
Just like, John, just throw a helicopter and see what happens.
Oh my
Let's
God.
See what you can do.
The military loves crashing helicopters. It's like their favorite thing to do.
That's like what's cops that, to dogs.
Yeah.
What's that plane that has like the rotating rotor?
Oh, Osprey.
That's killed more soldiers than like the Taliban has in the last 10 years.
Yeah, follow the white rabbit. All these accidents are not coincidences. QAnon.
Dude,
follow the rabbit.
If you really wanted to get like Jerome Corsi book sales, you would like make a graph where it's like amount of H-1 visas for engineers coming to America from like Pakistan and shit, and then deaths from the Osprey. That's the most Jerome Corsi shit you could do. Like, they're infiltrating our engineering departments and making shitty planes to kill our soldiers in, and they made the F-35 to bilk the military. Dude, if you want to be a Neo Bircher, I just gave you a fucking golden ticket. Pay off your fucking grad school debt this way. No one's going to listen to your podcast. They already have ours.
All right, man. We never tested this before, but we're pretty sure that we can fly the helicopter underwater as long as it's upside down. So strap on.
We are testing the military's first double jump over the Grand Canyon. At the apogee of your jump, Sergeant, jump again. We're drawing a real-life Tanuki suit. It was $3 trillion. We have lost 750 soldiers attempting the mushroom power-up. Does not create a bigger soldier.
Well, of course, because you're...
thousands of raccoons.
You are on a top-secret mission to try to jump on an Al-Qaeda commander's head to kill him. No one has ever tried this. We had an idea for like a really funny fake stupid TED talk by like a former army guy, but he's like the army guy who wears glasses, so he's smart, and he's like, the first few weeks of war are a shooter, pretty good because we're the best shooter players in the world. But then we have to play Civilization. But you can't help but wonder, maybe it would be better if we tried to play The Sims. Let me explain. And then the crowd just like fucking ejaculates.
I'm wondering if this war on terror isn't Dark Souls because of how hard it is. Am I right? Whoa.
It sure feels like we've been in Afghanistan for a fortnight or 10.
We got a real jet ski level from Battletoads going on.
Shout out Brian Garr.
Brian Garr claims to have beaten Battletoads. I'm not going to challenge him. This war started off as Battlefield 1, but we're in Battlefield Bad Company because there are a lot of bad soldiers, let's be honest.
Nailed it.
Okay, how do we exit this riff? We are requesting extraction from this riff. We need a helo or blowing smoke.
All podcasters will pass out if we go this high in a riff.
So our heroes, they make it into Afghanistan, and their mission is to link up with a Northern Alliance commander named General
General Daddy. He is very much the daddy of this movie.
He's a silver fox.
Yeah, he is a silver fox. He's a real person who is now a vice president of Afghanistan.
Oh, no, they meant that the actor is the vice president of Afghanistan. The real guy died.
I hate it when Hollywood tries to get into politics.
They meet up with a Northern Alliance commander. And now here's where a critical flaw, forget in the, you know, political valence of this movie. I mean, just as a movie, as a war movie, as an entertaining spectacle. The problem is essentially with their mission to begin with. Because I know that the movie is billed as 12 strong, you know, a ragtag team, the Dirty Dozen standing up against an entire army of Taliban.
Underdogs.
But their real mission in this is to just let the Northern Alliance show them where the Taliban are, paint the target with laser designators, and then just have B-52 bombers blow the shit out of everything.
Yeah, they had total air superiority.
Their job was pointing.
Yeah, it was the easiest gig ever. If you had a video game where your character had that kind of power, like that kind of firepower and that kind of ability to call in an overwhelming airstrike at any moment, the game would be panned for being incredibly easy and boring. It's just not a challenging mission.
Oh, absolutely.
But they have to make it that way because America's cultural industry is largely based on the premise of turning Goliath into David at any point that we can.
No, Grenada was the tutorial level, and Afghanistan was level one.
Have you noticed that so many of our recent war movies are like the screenwriters desperately searching for like a book that some ex-soldier wrote that's like, the one time a mission was really hard.
Yeah.
They're just so desperate for those stories.
And in this one, it still wasn't that hard, but they're like, hey, they had to ride horses. That's tough, right?
So at about, we actually clocked this. 34 minutes into the movie is when the first horse appears. And
it was awful.
Yeah.
And by then, we had only heard from Michael Shannon like twice.
Yeah. Oh, Shannon had no character
at
all.
Why even use your Shannon bucks on him? Like, you're going to give him those lines and that much little of a stage presence?
Yeah. Well, and like, spoiler alert, but he fucking dies. And like, we're all just miserable.
No, he does not die.
Well, we think he's going to die. And we're all fucking like miserable watching the screen, not because we became attached to the character, but because he's really the only interesting actor on the screen. Like, I would probably watch him in a Tyler Perry movie, to be honest. I'm always.
Are you kidding? That would be great.
That would rule. Oh my God, Tyler Perry, if you're listening, please cast Michael Shannon.
Medea, you are an outrageous woman.
Really, really underused Shannon, who is a delight.
So a lot of the interplay is between the time the movie's not focusing on Michael Shannon. What it is doing is focusing on Chris Hemsworth and General Daddy, the Northern Alliance commander. And it's this sort of, Orientalist narrative whereby a white guy has some sort of father figure of Eastern origin.
Which would have made more sense if Chris Hemsworth's father had like died or something.
No, they introduced a Mr. Miyagi with no actual paternal tension.
And General Daddy is sort of like, you don't have killer's eyes. You must have a warrior's heart. And the movie's about him sort of learning to both kill without conscience or feeling and also to develop a warrior's heart.
It's about him learning to paint the laser targets better, right, more efficiently, kill more people from the outer atmosphere.
You're not pointing fast enough. You're not a real warrior.
The other thing is, like, there's all this requisite shit of bringing up the graveyard of empires and pointing out how everyone got owned here before. Not us, though.
Yeah, and that is the funniest thing, because the audience for this film presumably knows that we're still in Afghanistan. Taliban rules most of it. It's totally restive. There's been no flowering democracy. We haven't saved the women of Afghanistan from oppression or any of the shit that got sold on this. And yet you're still supposed to take them seriously when they say, this battle is going to determine the future of Afghanistan. It's like, yeah, wow, it'd be terrible if it was an absolute war zone a decade and a half later.
Well, you bring up... The movie has one scene that reminds you why we're fighting. Actually, two scenes. Right before Chris Hemsworth goes into the helicopter to like take off over the mountains to start the mission, William Fichtner's character goes, the most important thing a man brings into battle is a reason why. Here's yours. It's a piece of the Twin Towers. And he literally gives him a shard of the World Trade Center. And he's like, 19 men attacked our country a couple weeks ago.
we're sending U-12 over the border to strike back.
Like, what if it's just like a piece of his driveway?
It's the reason why that matters, Amber, and that's why he's a good commander.
My shitty son chipped the new pavement.
That's so pathetic. If you're going to go full medieval Catholic relic worship, you know, make it, this is a FDNY guy's finger bone.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Make it like actually as ghoulish
that priest who died on 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah. A piece of that guy. This reminds me, I think I've maybe mentioned it on the show before, but like to me, one of the peak moments of like early aughts American nationalistic war on terror idiocy was former New York Governor George Pataki. When they pulled down that...
He was governor at the time.
He was governor... No, you know, I mean, he was governor at the time. I mean, former now. Anyway. Okay. Governor George Pataki, when the Saddam Hussein statue in the middle of Baghdad was torn down, and, you know, they were all hitting it with their shoes or whatever, Pataki went on TV and said, I think we should melt that statue down and put it in the rebar to rebuild the new Twin Towers.
Hell yeah. Fuck you, Saddam Hussein, and your fucking 9/11 doing. You mean the piece of shit?
It's not even like that. It's like he's a Bushwick Wiccan.
Yeah. No, conservatives think like statues and rebar are enchanted. And like the reason that we're still in Afghanistan is we didn't bring enough like shards of 9/11 with us to unleash level 10.
Holy fuck. I just remember the most infuriating thing about this movie was the very final title card that mentioned that there's a statue dedicated to these horse soldiers at World Trade Center Plaza right now.
We should go see that ugly ass statue. Yeah.
Let's go pay our respects to the horse soldiers.
No, what happened was on 9/11, they scattered all the pieces of the World Trade Center all around the world, and our troops had to acquire each one, put them back together.
If you get all 7 pieces of the World Trade Center and form the Black Eagle coin, you have one wish.
You have a
and
wish.
You have to bring back. You use it to bring back Chris Kyle and finally win the war on terror.
No, you use it to make property developer Donald Trump president.
They're like, oh no, we got the 9/11 shards. We got our fucking wish. Cut to Donald Trump just screaming at the kid mowing the lawn in the White House.
The other moment.
You mean the 9/11 shards? Obama chuckled.
Obama's previously swindled a patriot out of the 7th shard. Just let me hold the other 6. You like the 7th shard that only I possess, you can keep it. Obama blew his wish with the 9/11 dragon because he's like, the dragon's like, I can grant you one wonderful wish, Barry Sotero. And he's like, no, you can't. You didn't build that.
If you like your shard, you can keep it.
The other moment.
He thinks there's 57 shards.
The other
he
moment.
Saluted the dragon with a latte. Sorry.
Sorry. The other moment in the film that reminds you why we fight is the only scene where they attempt to characterize the villain, who's the Taliban commander.
Also, daddy.
Yeah, very daddy.
Ashians are fucking hot.
He's the Taliban commander, and there's a scene where it's like in some village they're occupying. And they have some woman like on her knees or whatever, and her daughter's lined up. And
I thought she was the teacher.
I thought it was the mother.
Well, she's teaching.
It was the mother.
She's teaching either her kids or someone's kids surreptitiously.
Yeah, he's teaching girl, and like the Taliban guy quizzes these girls by asking them what a giraffe is and what like 3 times 9 is.
Easy shit. I got them all.
And these girls are smart enough.
You'd have been so dead.
They're smart enough to answer the questions correctly, but not smart enough to realize that means their mom's going to get killed.
Yeah. What is a giraffe? Correct.
Well, yeah,
I'll take potent potables, Mr. Taliban.
Well, you have to remind the audience why the Taliban was the bad guys, because none of this makes sense otherwise.
Yes. And because, well, we drove out the guys who banned girls from school, we posted in the guys who love molesting underage boys and dealing insane amounts of heroin.
Oh, my God. What is it with you people? They hate kids or love them too much.
Make up your mind.
So... yeah, we get a scene of the Taliban guy executing a woman for teaching girls to read. And at one point, the General Daddy character says that, like, you know, when I ruled over this part of northern Afghanistan, you know, we had movies, women didn't wear the veil,
Yes.
They would flash their tits.
We thought we were more spiritual than religious, really.
we had to look up the general daddy character, and apparently that is true.
Yeah, he had been a communist commander during most of the war.
Uzbek communist.
Yeah, and he only switched at the end.
But he's also a fucking warlord. That's the ridiculous part of this movie.
I actually have to say, I realized, and I said this to Felix, I remember, I'm trying to think of how often I heard the word warlord.
At the beginning, time. Yeah, they said, we got to hook up with a warlord. And that's it.
No, during the actual, post 9/11, war, and then people started bringing up warlords, and it's one of those things where I'm like, oh, that sounds terrible. But I don't actually technically know what warlord is. I mean, I know what people mean when they say it, but maybe it's one of those words like terrorist that I have a general skepticism
of. It's a guy with an army who controls territory on the basis of having a military.
Yeah. Basically, if
tin pot despot.
Yeah, if you've got a cool outfit, if you have some sort of entourage.
A cool nickname.
Yeah.
If you have a beard like Matt's.
Yes. Anything like that, that makes you a warlord.
You'd be a great warlord, Matt.
Oh, I'd be an amazing warlord. I'd be one of those decadent warlords in a palanquin, and they bring me in, pulled by 15 guys, and then I order a village to be executed.
Instead of feeding you
I can see you eating an entire rotisserie chicken in your little canopy.
Oh, yeah.
Like going, over there, Grenadier.
Bring them to me!
It would be a warlord that looks like Rib Kid most of the time.
That would be carried in a canopy shaped like a croc.
Instead of bringing women to dance for your amusement, they bring in posts for you to read and get mad about.
TED Talk 2. We hear a lot about warlords. What about a peace lord?
So in the second act of this movie, they keep insisting that these are the stakes. The Green Berets are going to help this warlord retake Mazar-i-Sharif, which is the key to Afghanistan. And if we don't take it, we're going to lose the war, which is a very strange thing to think about right now.
Yeah, we kept all feeling very Mandela effect.
So we allied with the Northern Alliance, which was basically just a collection of these warlords. There was Daddy, and then there's another warlord who comes in later in the movie that Daddy doesn't like because they're Tajik versus Uzbek. And they keep saying things like, we know you hate the Taliban. This is your city. Fight for it. And it's like, why? Because he just has a big fucking ethnic army?
He's our ethnic army guy.
For like a day. He's been for like a week.
He let movies play when he was in charge.
That's it. Movies.
I have to find out what movies he let them play before I support
They
him.
Were all Woody Allen films.
It was Gosford Park.
All right. We need to call it an airstrike on this piece of shit.
They were all Woody Allen movies, but he showed it to the people who would... Unfortunately, he inadvertently showed it to the people who would go on to do 9/11, and that's why they did it.
Nothing happens in these movies. We must strike back at the heart of this degeneracy. What if that was Saeed Khatib's origin story? He watched, Hannah and her sisters, and he's like, this is so boring.
The West must fall.
Has this guy ever been out of Manhattan?
Yeah, so they say constantly in the movie, these are the stakes. And it's smaller and smaller each time. Like, at one point, there's a truck shooting rockets. It's like, we've got to take out that truck or we'll lose the battle. If we lose the battle, we won't take Mazar-i-Sharif. And if we don't take Mazar-i-Sharif, we'll lose the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it's like, I'm sure that would have happened. We didn't instantly take Mazar-i-Sharif. We would have been like, well, we're going home.
And
looks like we will stand for this.
And we did,
got licked.
We did win. After all, we took Afghanistan and then it slowly went away. And now it's basically just the president of Afghanistan is the mayor of Kabul and they have no run outside of there. And it's a war-torn hellscape.
Well, repeatedly at several points, Chris Hemsworth will say something like, if we don't win here, then the whole fucking country is going to be a terrorist training camp. And what happened on September 11th is going to happen over and over and over again. And then in the last push, to capture this one mountain pass, they're like, this is it, guys. We have the chance to drive Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan forever.
Yeah. And they even face off against the Taliban towards the end. One of the units, they make pains to say, this is Unit 55, foreign fighters, they're Al-Qaeda. And at one point when they're spying them with their glasses, they somehow see a flag or something and they go, oh, those are the Al-Qaeda guys. So they get to actually kill the Al-Qaeda guys. And it's not just the Taliban, it's specifically the Al-Qaeda guys who did 9/11.
Al-Qaeda and Taliban just totally interchangeably throughout this movie.
Yeah. but they specifically bring them in at the end to be the guys that they fight so that they can feel like they're getting revenge for 9/11.
If the horse soldiers just went out into the middle of the field and reenacted Mr. Hands until they got ripped apart by 50 cals, Afghanistan would be exactly the same how it is now.
Correct.
Literally zero stakes move.
And well, the thing is so you got two problems with stakes. One is the knowledge throughout the thing that nothing these people are going to do is going to matter. Secondly, it is that the actual contours of their job, as we said earlier, are, okay, so we move to the front line. We see where the Taliban are. We call in an airstrike and they get blown up. Yeah, then we move forward. We see them again. We call it in. We blow them
there's
up.
There's at least 100 airstrikes in this movie.
Yeah, it's just a pure domination of the world's largest military against a ragtag, poorly developed force with no air force.
I mean, that's the thing, though. It circles back to how fucking bland the characters are, how shitty the dialogue is, how there's zero development of any of them. It's like you can have a movie where you know what happens 10 years down the line, where you know it's a futile cause or whatever. Futile.
Yeah, we made Titanic.
Right. And it's shout out to Jimmy. You're the king. You would never make this piece of shit. But you actually need to develop the characters to do that.
Yeah.
They just did neither in this case. They didn't present anything with any stakes, nor did they have literally any of the characters with Michael Shannon could have died and we would have not have noticed.
Well, that's the other thing. Spoiler alert. None of the 12 strong guys die at all.
And
none of them are even like minorly imperiled.
Yeah,
like
one guy hurts his
Michael
knees.
Shannon gets
Michael Shannon. Okay, he gets injured and he has to be medevaced. He gets injured when in a column of a wave of surrendering Taliban soldiers.
Yes,
and he's like, "Lay down your arms. You were surrender to us." And then one of them, of course, just detonates a suicide bomb and blows half of them up.
Yep, just a perfect little example of why they can't be trusted and
using our values against us.
And you can't have that kind of softness. You have to kill them. And so, even though they didn't show it, it's just sort of a sub rosa justification for the fact that while this was happening in real life, the Northern Alliance was just packing shipping containers with Taliban prisoners who they literally suffocated to death.
Also, the movie just destroys the stakes explicitly when back in base camp, Rob Riggle finds out that, oh, these guys are they're doing the wrong thing here. They're on horses. That's stupid. We didn't approve that. Let's just send the other team of better guys with a different warlord to take Mazar-i-Sharif first.
Yeah, so basically you're just rooting for them to have their guy do it.
Well, you're rooting for them because Chris Hemsworth has to learn a lesson from Daddy about having a warrior's heart.
But again, you don't... your only pre-war character development of Chris Hemsworth is like, he has a daughter. That's it.
He was very unhappy about 9/11.
Why would you give a shit if this guy learns how to become a man on the battlefield? What, like, so... I hope he has PTSD when he comes home and sees his daughter. I hope he has the experience of killing several people when he goes to raise her over several years.
At the end of movies like this, they shouldn't just say what happened to each guy. They should say which ones were cheated on by their wives. Yeah. And how many times a number a tally
or,
each one.
Or which ones saw Navy SEALs stealing pallets of cash, tattled on them, and then got immediately murked by the SEALs. You know what else is the other thing about this movie? This proves what we've always thought. We were talking about this the other day. Green Berets, Virgins, Navy SEALs, Chads.
Yeah. Now, the Navy SEALs don't take shit from anybody. They deal the opium. They deal the guns. They fucking pilfer money. They strangle anyone who gets in their way. They leave the force and then become rapist governors and heads of international mercenary armies.
But do they have horses?
They don't need horses. No, they are horses.
Virgil, they have SEALs.
they ride to work.
Yeah.
They all work in Venice.
I do have a theory that I want to develop further on a future show that the Navy SEALs are essentially the skull and bones of the 21st century national security state. It's where like the future elite is honed and initiated into the secrets of power.
The Navy SEALs are like the Green Beret, every special force that we have, their job is just to like walk around, shoot people in the back of the head, give people pallets of cash. But only the SEALs are so bold as to say, I want to skim off that pallet.
Yeah.
We're going to do an entire SEAL episode.
We got to do a SEAL episode.
We've been like talking about it. It's like, whoa, this guy who's a notorious piece of shit is a SEAL. This guy is. And there's this weird story about the Navy SEALs killing the guys in Africa.
Yeah. It's a very interesting organization, to say the least.
They rock. I respect 100% what they do.
So the movie...
I mean, it's hard, like... I realize that, like, trying to narrate what happens in this movie presents some difficulties for doing the podcast, because, like, nothing really happens.
No.
It's very hard to describe.
They
like,
go to a position, they need to bomb it, and then they have to contrive some reason to make it somewhat more dramatic than just calling in coordinates and waiting for bombing. So one time, the bombing is missing, so they have to get closer and dangerously close so that they can... be more accurate in their call-in or something. Or, oh no, the plane's out of fuel, so we can't get bombing for a few minutes and we have to shoot it out. They always have to... It's like a night boat. There's always a fjord.
There's always a fjord.
It's like there's always some contrived reason to make it not as blankly, grindingly technological as they're the bad guys, let me call in the airstrike.
Okay, well, here's the climax of the movie. Daddy's troops have left because he doesn't like the other warlord.
He wants to get there first.
And, you know, they don't like each other because the guy that the Taliban assassinated a few days before 9/11 was the only one keeping the whole thing together. So Chris Hemsworth guys have to go alone and, reach Mazar-e Sharif first.
No, the big climax of the movie is they have to reach a pickup truck with a bunch of cool rockets on the back of it.
They're trying to cut off reinforcements to Mazar-e Sharif from a pass, and that's where they... ambush a bunch of Taliban and Al-Qaeda guys and stop a Katyusha battery.
Yeah. So there's a battery there, and they're like, we have to stop this battery. We got to do it. We got to cut it off. If this one truck holds the key to the future of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
If we don't do it,
yeah.
Then...
And that is where we have a scene that apparently occurred in real life of the troops charging a Taliban position on horseback, firing from the saddle. That did happen, apparently, but in real life, it was just the Afghan soldiers. But here, we've got fucking Chris Hemsworth and his Green Berets riding on the... They're literally appropriating heroism
from
the
valor.
Afghans.
They're stealing valor.
Yeah, valor theft.
They're valor theft because it's cool. Because they're not really the horse soldiers of Afghanistan if they don't charge into battle on horseback, even though that never fucking happened.
So it turned out the horses were the most powerful weapon all along.
Yeah.
And in what pissed me off so much was, I guess, the dramatic climax of it, where they corner the mullah and who's trying to drive away in a shitty car, and his car gets stuck. And Daddy comes up to him and just raises a gun at him, and he says something in a foreign language and then shoots him, and that's it. And we have no idea.
The movie did not provide a subtitle to that. We were watching the movie with subtitles on, and all it just said was other foreign language.
There were like dozens of cool things he could have said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Car trouble. Call AAA. That's a good one.
Say hi to the virgins for me.
What did you say? School's out?
School's out. Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, that's good.
That would have been good because it would have been a callback to him killing the teacher.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, like the Taliban commander at the end tries to flee the battlefield cowardly. And I was like, well, I respect his anti-school agenda, but I'm not. But this leaving the battlefield thing is really for the birds.
Yeah, he
you
just,
are an officer.
See, that's the thing. We got some. You get mad at him for shooting the school teacher, but he was just reading N+1 magazine. The New Inquiry.
Inquiry. Doesn't feel so good, does it?
Inquiry also is correct.
Yeah, if you're English.
Do you say aluminium?
Tally ho. Tally ho.
You calling a ho?
So, closing thoughts on 12 Strong.
Too much soldier. Not enough horse.
The horses didn't even have names.
That's true.
Yeah.
Barely any horse interaction. There wasn't a scene where one of the horses led the guy off and he couldn't stop it. And he's like, no.
That would have been funny.
Hilarious. Nobody got thrown off the horse.
Yeah. Or one guy who like cartoonishly can't ride a horse.
Or the guy trying to pull the horse by the reins and he's got to dig his heels in and the horse is dragging him
like
away
that.
Comically.
One cartoonishly fat horse and the horse looks at him and runs away.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Dude,
nobody rides backward on the horse.
Yeah. The horse doesn't like what is being fed, so they have to feed the horse their own rations
and
they're really upset about it.
Someone smokes weed around the horse and the horse gets a second.
Yes.
Yeah. Gets really hungry.
I guess the horse likes Hindu Kush.
Oh, man. Well,
Hollywood, please hire us.
My final
note. The script doctors.
My final note on this movie. There exists a story about soldiers, men at war, noble killers, people who stand on the wall and protect us, and untamed beasts. the beast we have to tame to mend the fences between man and man. It explores their complex relationships with these animals, the danger they face, and the insanity and dark comedy of war. It's called Operation Dumbo Drop, not this movie.
My closing thoughts on the movie is it brings to mind the classic Mystery Science 3000 rule in the film episode Overdrawn at the Memory Bank, which is never remind the audience of a better movie in the middle of a shitty movie. I sort of did this to myself, self-imposed drill, by watching Lawrence of Arabia last week, and that movie has been on my mind ever since rewatching it. And it struck me because it's basically the same plot as this movie. You know, a crazy British officer goes into the middle of fucking nowhere to link up with the locals and fight against the Turk. But, you know, Lawrence of Arabia had a better score, and the point of that movie was that T. E. Lawrence was pretty much insane and kind of wanted to die. So the Horse Soldiers movies had that basically the same plot points, but all the shit T.E. Lawrence did was a million times more impressive than this shit. And just Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean's 1962 masterpiece, starring Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, Anthony Quinn, and Omar Sharif, five bags of popcorn, an all-time masterpiece. Watch that movie, not this.
Also watch Stripes.
Watch The Matrix. Watch anything. Don't watch one of these movies. Don't encourage
these movies. Are so bad. And it's really depressing how bad they are and how they keep getting made.
This is the only genre of movie that probably upsets me more than the superhero laser green screen movies, the Christian Amanpour war movies. Get rid of them.
So dispiriting. Just if you have any hope in your heart that we might wise up and get the fuck out of Afghanistan and realize what a just disastrous horror show we've created there. Just think about the fact that in the year 2017, someone made a movie about the opening days of the Afghan war with the general fucking gist being, watch the crucial moment where we won the war in Afghanistan. They're making that movie in 2017 when the war in Afghanistan is the longest running war in American history, where we're only a year or so away from someone who was born the day it started being eligible to fight in it. And you can fucking spend tens of millions of dollars and use Hollywood actors to tell a triumphant story of what we've accomplished in Afghanistan, that there is no real cultural embrace of exactly what we've done there, and as such, no pressure to end it, which means it will just continue going on with its own horrible zombie logic until the end of time.
My closing thought is we should have done Chappaquiddick.
These movies, it's like you take a huge family-sized bag of chips and you eat them all. But they're Fritos. You're just chewing for like just Fritos nothing with any seasoning on it. Just sort of salt and corn until you're exhausted. Fritos you're just exhausted, but you're bloated. You spent a lot of calories, but for what?
For Fritos. They're delicious.
You like Fritos?
Yeah. They're great.
I like Fritos in small amounts. They are very salty.
I will admit that I only have ever eaten them in the small bag.
Fritos is like Ned Flanders' favorite chip.
They're way too spicy for Ned Flanders.
You think they're spicy? You fucking honky.
Until next time, guys.
They're too spicy for Ned Flanders.
If you buy a big bag of Fritos, you are a psychopath.
You are nuts if you do that.